So originally I was just going to speak about my initiative, not my initiative, but the initiative called MRAIN, which I'll tell you a little bit about in a second. But I decided to change it up a little bit because I was consulting on the MRAIN project 2 years ago, and since then, with the Arab Spring and the Syrian civil war, the climate's very different in the region, which means that changes everything regarding to MRAIN and other oral and public health initiatives in that region. So I am going to speak about MRAIN and about a little bit about the World Federation Public Health Association's Oral Health Working Group, those initiatives and some projects that are happening in the Levant area in specific. A little bit about the refugee situation and even less about the fluoridation situation. So in 2009, they conceptualized the World WHO and American University of Beirut, the idea of MRAIN, which is a very long name, Eastern Mediterranean Regional Academic Institution Network for Public Health. We're just going to call it MRAIN. And the idea was to create a network of public health institutions in the Eastern Mediterranean region that would share best practices, influence policy, and improve health systems. So during my time consulting there in 2011 and beginning of 2012, we mapped 266 public health institutions, which was difficult in itself because a lot of those institutions are not accessible or searchable online, so word of mouth and finding institutions through institutions. We created a survey instrument about the public health academic institutions, asking them about their academic degree programs, their research, their workforce capacity, and the services that they're providing. And I'll get back to the last one. I'll get back to the last point in a second, actually. Challenges of creating a platform like MRAIN. So the conceptual framework of MRAIN. Like I said, it's the sharing of best practices, shaping policy and health systems, and this conceptual framework here shows that there would be a service component, an educational component, which are the academic institutions, and then an archive of updated research database inputted by people of the institutions in the Eastern Mediterranean region. With that, that would mostly be an online platform with the future plans of it going offline and having cross-institutional workshops and so forth. What challenges come up are when you actually look at what EMRO means. You're talking about a very diverse group of 22 countries, of which all of them have extremely different GDP. So if you compare Qatar or the UAE, which have some of the highest GDPs, to Somalia or South Sudan, you're talking about trying to share best practices across a very diverse group of countries. And also their public health practices. But number one is the difference in technological infrastructure in all of these countries makes trying to create an online platform very challenging. This is our first regional advisory board meeting. And the reason I wanted to talk about the dental public health survey that was launched by the World Federation for Public Health Association, because once the survey is launched for MRAIN, for public health institutions, and the survey is launched for the dental public health survey, there'll be a great opportunity to collaborate and see the crossover between oral health infrastructure building and general public health infrastructure building. So I'm really excited to see if we can incorporate the findings from this research into the MRAIN database and in the inclusion of the discussion of oral health. What another challenge from the MRAIN project was realizing how in a region where there's political and economic instability, it's very difficult to keep preventative care and public health at the forefront of priorities when it comes to financing. So imminent needs, emergency care is obviously a priority, which means incredible initiatives like MRing get pushed to the back burner. And when we're talking about sustainability and in change, we also need to think about sustainable business models and financing to create that sustainable change, so that when we do launch an initiative like MRain, that we know that it's not going to be cut in a year or 2 years. So that got me on my journey around the Mediterranean. During my time living in Beirut, I saw incredible innovation and initiatives in social impact, and I wanted to dedicate 5 months to learning more about what kind of social impact individuals and organizations, startups were starting in that region. And I'm just going to highlight one of them as an example. But in Lebanon, there's Donor Sang Compter, which is a blood bank. But what they've done is they've streamlined gathering and distribution of blood in a country where it used to be gathered on an emergency basis and through public service announcements, through the radio, and a very informal system that for something that's vital, especially in a country that's neighboring and housing a lot of refugees from the civil war. So this is it's not a social business, it is a social entrepreneurial venture, but it highlights that people are taking the initiative on themselves to start making the changes that they know the government isn't capable of making right now, the economy can't provide right now, and the policy isn't changing right now, not in their favor at least. So there's incredible innovation going on. People are taking ownership to change what they want to see changed in the community themselves, the refugee population. Before 2011, there was already about 1.4 million Palestinian refugees in the Levant area, and added to that now, in the last 2 years, have been 2 million Syrian refugees, not including the 4 million displaced within Syria. So you can imagine also infrastructure is very limited, but it's even more limited now. Most of those refugees are being absorbed into Lebanon and Jordan as being the two largest, and then following that, Turkey, Iraq, and Egypt. UNRWA, in 2007, had done a survey and found that there were 32 oral health consultations per dentist daily. In 2009, in Lebanon, they did a follow-up survey, and they found that there was one dentist to every 17,000 refugees. They had 19 full-time dentists, 5 part-time dentists, and only 19 fixed clinics throughout the whole country. So since then, added on to that 800,000 Syrian refugees in Lebanon alone, those numbers change. Today, there was actually another infographic that came out saying that because they closed all the UNRWA the UNRWA schools in Syria, 2 out of 3 Palestinian children then had no schools to go to. 35% of those were absorbed in the UNRWA schools in Lebanon, which means all these numbers are affected, and the numbers are expected to be double. Student numbers are expected to be double in Jordan than they currently are. What does that mean? The information on it under workforce, education, and services was even before the Syrian civil war. So in Lebanon, healthcare professionals their degrees are not recognized in the country. It means that they're limited to working in the camps. In Syria, they're recognized, but because of the civil war and displacement, those professionals also aren't able to perform in Syria as well. CE training is mostly done on restorative work. So the Palestinian Dental Association 2 years ago decided they were going to hold an annual conference to promote more diverse continuing education courses and workshops to increase capacity of dentists in the camps. Education. In Lebanon, in the first the first time students or children have exposure to oral health education is when they attend school, which is at the age of 6 years old. So from birth to 6 years, there's no exposure to oral health education for the mother or for the child. Of those children screened at 6 years of age, only 20 to 30% of them actually go on to get treatment. And in terms of preventative care, in Lebanon, it's at 6 years of age that they get sealants. In Syria, they don't get sealants, and of course, this was before the war, so all of these, that means something completely different now. And then in Jordan, only high-risk students get sealants. When I visited the Shatila Palestinian refugee camp a few years back to check out the oral health program, and I was impressed. Most of the students had the basic oral hygiene kits. They were getting educated by their faculty. I went to a local preschool where they also, every child had their own cup with their toothbrush and toothpaste and was getting oral health education there as well. But again, most of that doesn't start until the age of 6 years old. As for services, pregnant women are getting screened for oral health, but most of them are not receiving the care that they need afterwards and are not being given fluoride supplements. In the camps, there's no centralized water system, so fluoridation doesn't exist, which means that they would have to rely on supplements, but they're too expensive for most family incomes to afford. And as for UNRWA's oral health program, it was not being integrated into the maternity and child health prevention program, the health protection and promotion program, and the anti and postnatal health education program. So in all of these very fundamental education programs for mothers and children, there was no element of oral health care in those programs. Some initiatives that have come out that are promoting more exposure and integration of the international community is the Colgate internship program in the Palestinian refugee camps. There was a signing between the Lebanese University Dental School and Tufts School of Dental Medicine for a partnership and opportunities for international collaboration. And when it comes to Syrian refugees, there is a program called Zaytuna, and I'll tell you about that in 2 seconds. Zaytuna is funded by the Karam Foundation, and the current situation is that they have very few clinics. They're providing free dental care for Syrians inside Syria on the border of Turkey and in Turkey. But there's still very high demand. They did a needs assessment in November 2012. They returned 1 year later to serve 400 children in the Atmiyat camp. And they provided oral hygiene instruction and kits to all of the children. And they're planning to return this December again. There were only two dental mobile clinics that were being funded in a camp in Jordan, but those were privately funded even. So capacity is really low, and the financial support is basically whoever privately thinks that this is a priority to be funded. They had actually reached out to the Syrian opposition asking for funding, and even the ACU, which is the humanitarian aid arm of the Syrian opposition, itself is poorly funded. So everyone's reaching out to everyone, but no one really has capacity. These are some pictures from their last trip in June. So you see the oral health instruction pictures on the lower left and right, and treatment on the lower right. But it's for adults and for children. One last thing about the EMRO region and oral health is that during my time there, I also found that there were few oral health country officers. So highlighting how much that this is not really a priority on the public health agenda. Also that a lot of the research that has been done about oral health in the region is outdated. I think the last DMFT I could find was in some countries was 2003. and that a lot of them are questionable in validity and reliability. And finally, water fluoridation. Lebanon has the highest DMFT in the EMRO region at 3.4, followed by Jordan, Afghanistan. I'm sure these are probably going to increase with the refugee situation. You can see Dr. Peterson's charting. You can see actually it's very small, but that little red dot on the right is Lebanon and Jordan do have the two highest in that region. And fluoridation has been on the table since 1998. Dr. Doumi and Dr. Duran, both from the Lebanese University Dental School and School of Public Health, are leading the efforts for water fluoridation in the region. It's been stagnating, I think, for the last 2 years because of policy. And just that the infrastructure isn't even available. So a lot of parts of the country are supported through wells. So obviously there's going to be an issue in terms of centralizing fluoridation in those areas, plus the camps. And then the infrastructure to update is more costly than providing supplementation. So that is it.
Thank you. Well, we've gone from a very comprehensive program to a region of the country that has, because of the instability of the government and the politics, the people are suffering in many ways, including poor oral health and not having access to dental services. What I'd like to do now is open it up for questions from the audience or from the panelists with each other, among themselves. And I'm not seeing a question. Let me ask Irene. Irene, it's very impressive that you take an effective prevention program and get it to become national policy. Could you come up here and tell us how you did it? Because we'd like to do it in the United States.
Thank you, Dr. Myra. So before it becomes national policy, I make it local first. I have been working for school oral health for 16 years, and I have been managed more than 23 schools. So we have enough data collected from 1995, and it showed that with the conventional program that our government has, they has the school oral health treatment on third and fifth year of the school children. We found out that if we wait until third and fifth years, it will be very late, because we have data that when you enter the first grade is already two permanent teeth decay. So if you want to prevent, then you have to start it in the kindergarten. So we collected data from the 13 schools, and we presented many times to the Ministry of Health to ensure that they should change their program and move earlier. So they also we introduced with the iron donut risk assessment, and by doing the iron donut risk assessment, it proves that people get empowered. So it's no longer the Ministry of Health who is very tired of taking care of the health, but many people then stood up and willing to provide the budget. So by that, in 2011, then Ministry of Health accommodated this as the national policy.
Could you say a word or two about the population of Indonesia? And roughly how many children are we talking about?
Yeah, the population is 250 million. 250 million people in Indonesia. And
was a decree by the Minister of Health.
Well, does this have to go through a Congress or legislature, or does the Minister of Health just implement it?
Oh, yeah, it's gone through many meetings because they invite from many provinces. We have like 33 provinces. So we have many meetings to discuss. And because our data show that every province different rate of severity, so it has to be risk-based approach rather than mass approach. And we have proof that since 1955, we have no improvement. So if we keep doing what we are doing, then we won't get anywhere.
So each provincial health ministry of health approved it?
Yes.
And then it could be approved nationally?
Yes, correct. Yeah, it's a long process.
What's the access to dental care to the general population of adults? And it seems that children are getting services. What's happening to adults and seniors in Indonesia?
We have what we call the Puskesmas. It's a public health service in every small region. But our dentist is only 25,000 compared to 250 million population. And so if we just focus on the curative side, we won't help much. So that's why we have to focus now on the preventive. And to focus on the preventive, first we have to start early. And secondly, the community has to have that ownership to make it work. Previously, we see that when we give dental health education, it's on the dental health officer that feels the need, but the community doesn't feel the needs. But now we build that this is your need, not us. Mm-hmm. So you take the responsibility to act.
Do you have dental therapists in Indonesia?
No, but we have dental nurses.
Yes.
That's comparable. What can dental nurses do?
By doing the innovative school oral health, we meant that the dental nurse can do this. So the preventive can be done by the dental nurse, and the dentist can then concentrate on the late stages of the caries.
Do dental nurses do fillings as well?
Yes, one surface filling they can do.
Okay. In America, we just make more dental schools.
Right.
We have many dental schools. Thank you.
Bruce, you talked about an innovative initiatives at Harvard. What do your graduates end up doing? How many of them go into public health or get involved in community service? Do you have any information or data on that?
I think the last 10% of every class is going into public health service.
Great.
I was at the School of Public Health Symposium last Friday. I ran into two graduates who were full-time at new schools of public health. I didn't realize there are many new schools of public health in the United States, too.
Yeah.
Almost as many as law schools.
Oh, we've got a way to go there. Bettina, could you say something about how the physicians in the World Federation have responded to there being an oral health initiative, and has this sensitized them more to oral health?
Well, you mentioned physicians. You have seen that our members are always interdisciplinary associations. We do not accept associations that do not have all the backgrounds that are needed in public health. So it is more, I would say, the reaction of the public health community and not so much of physicians. This is still what we're going to explore. But there is an openness. I see more problems coming up with the real people looking for oral health, like ENT surgeons, dentists, and surgeons like you. There is a little bit of, how to put it nicely politically, well, they are all on the same cake and they think there is something to lose. We want to show that there is something to improve and something to get more out of it. And I think that's also one of the interesting works we are going to lead together. That's I think, the challenge we see. for the public health community, I think it's to open up their eyes. And as I mentioned, I think it's a good moment in time because the NCD is very high on the agenda. And if you explain that all of these NCDs have risk factors that go over oral health, they say, oh yes, indeed. I think public health community is open but hasn't got the information until now.
I just want to tell a quick story, then I'm going to ask Layla a question. A number of years ago, there was a French physician who went to El Salvador to provide primary medical care to the people in El Salvador in rural areas. And he found he was just overwhelmed with dental needs. He went to organized dentistry there, and they had no interest in providing care in the rural areas. So long story short, he developed a dental care delivery system. He took individuals as young as 12 years of age. In 6 months, taught them to drill and fill. And in 2 more months, he taught them to do dentures and trained about 200 individuals who worked in rural areas in El Salvador providing dental care to people who never had it. And I have a video on that. And when you see the video, you see most of the adults before this program began, almost all the denturists. And now for the first time, this program began maybe 12 or 15 years ago. I don't know what happened since, but the politics at that time, they had to be very careful in terms of what they did, because if people didn't like what you were doing, you got killed because of how the politics were in our country. A little different than here. Is there a dental school there? So long story short, here's a physician who responded to the need but developed a workforce to respond to that need. Layla, in terms of what's happening in the Middle East with Syria and Lebanon, et cetera, in terms of these refugee camps, I had worked in the refugee camps in Vietnam, and it's just overwhelming. Could you say a little bit more about, has anyone looked at the needs and how often are people providing services? Are there many people with pain and infection on a regular basis? Could you talk a little bit more about that? And then I do have one of my students here from Syria. He's a Syrian dentist. I want him to say something also about Syria. But he graduated dental school 2 years ago, 150 members in his class, and he told me almost every member of his class has left Syria. So in terms of dentists in Syria, you know, things will get worse, as well as the refugee camps.
I don't have exact numbers for how many dentists there are and how many people are being provided. I can say, in general, when it comes to humanitarian aid, there's a difficulty retaining dentists inside of Syria because, in general, Syrians are being displaced, but also healthcare providers that are going to assist on the borders of Syria, let's say in Turkey and Jordan, are actually getting recruited to go to the UAE because they are being told that if you come with your families, you'll get paid a lot more out here. And to them, it's a win in that it's still more money than they're getting paid on the border, and more money, definitely more money than they're getting paid inside Syria. So there's a struggle to retain help in Syria. A lot of the aid is not centralized, and it's coming in from different organizations that are not coordinated. There's a 33% VAT taxation from, let's say, Turkey to bring in any resources into Syria. So it means losing a third of the funding that's coming in to help, whether it's paying for the workforce or paying for the materials. So it's a bit of a crisis on a humanitarian level regarding oral health and any type of health. But a lot of the help is coming from U.S.-based dentists going and doing mission trips. It's not sustainable, but they are saying now that they want to streamline the humanitarian aid because it is predictable now what the needs are, how often, and what the materials quantities and all of that.
Akram, do you want to come up and say a few words? This is Dr. Akram Sanai. He doesn't know I was going to ask him, but he came from Syria recently. Do you want to say a few words?
Yeah, so I came from Syria 2 years ago, and I have been working with Dr. Lukian for 6 months, and it's like it's an honor to learn more about like public health in the U.S. and all over the world from Dr. Lukian. He has like a lot of experience, and I have been his shadow for 6 months, and I have been learning everything from him. So it's an honor working for him. And I want to thank Laila. Your presentation like meant a lot for me. Like I know the crisis that's happening, and as Dr. Lukian said, graduating from a class, 150 dentists, we graduated, and nobody, like only 5 dentists remained inside Syria. And most of them are working with the Free Army, and they are mostly concentrating on the medical like emergencies, not the dental emergencies. So they are not even working as dentists. So what I want to say is that the as you said, there is no organizations, the organizations that are funding and working to like raise the public health in the camps, in the refugee camps. They are working outside of the camps, and it's the funding is going. My friends who are working in the camps, they are saying a lot how the funding is misdistributed, and or the organizations, they will, they think that they are like sending the fund, and the fund is like used in the appropriate way, but it's not, which is very unfortunate. Like I'll give an example. I have a friend who's working in a hospital in the border on Turkey in a camp, a refugee camp, and this the distribution of medicine that's coming. He's a pharmacist. And he's telling me like a lot of organizations are sending like thousands and thousands like as a money, as medications, and those medications are stocked in like in warehouses, and nobody is using them. And in another areas, it's like a lack of medication. People are dying, children are dying of lack of medication. Yeah.
Both sides.
Yeah. Another example about it. He told me he had a patient who came into the clinic. He was an emergency patient. He ran out from Syria to the hospital, and after they medicate the patient and he left the hospital, he came after 2 months in a very fancy car. In he wearing a suit, and my friend was told that a lot of the funding, like the medical funding that came to this organization, was distributed through like giving money to those patients, rather than like distributing the money in like more functional ways. So I have to say, like I'm looking forward for the organizations to be more involved in treating the problems inside the camps, not like only caring about it and sending funds toward it. So thank you so much.
What would get you to go back?
For me, my original plan is to get stronger as a dentist, take my specialty and be like more educated as a public health and oral public health advocate. When I go there, I will have the strength, I will have the education that will help me to really raise like my country in public health in general. And I have been learning a lot, and I have a plan. I can see myself and my classmates who came here to America, and we are learning a lot. We're gonna go back there, and we're gonna change, hopefully after everything ends. And
is it safe to go back? The way things are now, is it safe to go back?
Of course not. If I came back to Syria right now, my name is at the borders. They're gonna take me to the take me to serve in the army. So it's impossible to go back there right now. The only thing that we can do right now, be members of organizations who are helping the Syrian refugees, like SAMS, the Syrian American Medical Society. and like just participating as like as a dentist here, like studying here in the US. So I know that I'm not doing that much right now in helping the real situation that's happening, but I'm gonna do be like a big part of it in the future. So I hope so. Okay. Thank you.
Any questions from the audience on anything?
You know, I'd just say there's an organization called Alliance Across Borders for Oral Health. It's been a meeting that started in Philadelphia 2 years ago. It's an outgrowth of a cooperation between Hebrew University and El Quds University in Jerusalem. But they're looking for situations just like that to help. I'll give you my card. You should contact them.
I will.
But you should come to that meeting. We're looking for areas of conflict to deal with.
I have another student here. Olga, do you want to say a few words about dentistry in Russia?
Of course, in Russia, it's not such conflict situation as in Syria, but unfortunately, we also deal with inefficiency of dental degree because not everyone can afford it, and unfortunately we have a very small amount of the dentists who can help. And I saw the map about how many dentists there. It's not equally through the whole Russia. We have a very concentrated area next to the border with Europe, but unfortunately if you go more centrally in Russia, there is even no dentist for the whole city. And most of the patients have just deal with the pain and do some natural extraction who some neighbors can help. I heard about that, and it's unfortunately happening right now. And we have a new program which is government supporting. It's distribution dentists who graduated dental schools, and they paid if they're going back to central Russian work and help people by the government support.
Okay, could you tell the audience what a natural extraction is?
Without anesthesia, not educated person extracting your teeth without even instrument.
Thank you. Any other questions before we close? I have another student from Iraq coming to my office, and we sort of have a United Nations there of students. And, you know, many of them are foreign-trained dentists. I've been working with foreign-trained dentists since 1970 to try and get them jobs and location or education in this country. So I get these students all the time. They're dentists, but I call them students. Let me thank the panel for fantastic presentations.